sacked by Michael Strahan.
I will always remember the Giant fans.
10, 5, touchdown!
The Giants are going to the Super Bowl.
Welcome to another edition of Giants Chronicles, presented by New York Presbyterian Hospital. I'm Bob Papa in the Legacy Club at MetLife Stadium. The New York Giants have a rich tradition, having won 8 NFL championships, 4 Super Bowls, and 4 NFL titles. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll take a look at the early years, the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, when the Giants won 4 NFL titles and played in the greatest game ever played. The 50s were known as the Golden Age, and for the New York Football Giants, it was a golden era. Sit back and enjoy this look back at Giants history. In the early 1920s, pro football was a game played primarily in small towns like Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Iron Mountain, Michigan. But in 1925, the league offered a New York franchise to a 38-year-old sports entrepreneur named Tim Mara.
My father said, how much is it? And I'm not sure whether it was $500 or $2,500. And this time, he had never even seen a football game. And they told him what the price was, and he said, well, he said, an empty store with chairs in it is worth that much in New York City, and that's how he became a pro football magnate.
The New York Football Giants began playing their games in the famed Polo Grounds located in Upper Manhattan. The original Giants roster was a ragtag group of journeyman players that included the legendary but aging Jim Thorpe. Despite their humble beginnings, the Giants began to field a string of winning teams. And in 1927, they were awarded their first NFL championship after posting an 11-1-1 record with a defense led by future Hall of Famer Cal Hubbard that recorded 10 shutouts and allowed only 20 points all season. In 1930, Tim Mara handed over control of the team to his two sons, Jack and Wellington Mara. And in 1931, Steve Owen was named head coach and would remain in that position for the next 23 years. Led by Pro Bowl center and future Hall of Famer Mel Hine, fullback Ken Strong, and wide receiver Morris Red Bagbro, the Giants advanced to the NFL championship game against the Chicago Bears in 1934. With the temperature at 9 degrees and the Polo Grounds field covered with a sheet of ice, this game would become known as the Sneakers Game, when head coach Steve Owen provided his squad with basketball shoes to give his players better traction on the slippery field.
Ray Flaherty was our assistant coach. He said that one year at Gonzaga, which is where Ray had gone to school, we won a game by using basketball shoes on the field, on a frozen field just like this. And he suggested that the Giants do the same thing. We had working with us a tailor named Abe Cohen. He volunteered to go up to Manhattan College and get the basketball shoes for the basketball team. And he got back, I think he had about 8 or 10 pairs of sneakers.
When we came out in the second half, and some of the Bears come, got over there and got looking around, and they saw that we had tennis shoes on. They went over and told Ellis, hey, those guys got tennis shoes on over there. Ellis says, step on their toes. Please.
The Giants responded by scoring 27 points in the fourth quarter. Fullback Ken Strong, who was also the place kicker, accounted for 17 points single-handedly, scoring 2 touchdowns, a field goal, and 2 extra points. The Giants went on to capture their second NFL championship with a convincing 30-13 win. 4 years later, the Giants once again hosted the NFL championship game at the Polo Grounds, this time against the Green Bay Packers. The Giants captured their third NFL championship with a thrilling 23-17 victory and became the first team to win 2 NFL championship games. But it would be the Giants' last championship celebration for nearly 2 decades. Stay tuned for more Giants Chronicles presented by New York Presbyterian, the early years. Welcome back to Giants Chronicles presented by New York Presbyterian Hospital, the early years. From 1927 to 1953, the New York Giants would win three NFL titles and appear in eight NFL championship games. And the one constant during that era was head coach Steve Owen. Owen never had a written contract with the Giants, relying on only a handshake agreement with owner Tim Mara. But that didn't stop him from making the Giants a consistent contender in the NFL.
Well, Steve Owen was really, I think, the rock that we built on. He was reliable and trustworthy, and he was, those were formative years for me. He was like my second father.
Owen was known as a defensive mastermind and is credited with establishing defensive excellence as a Giants trademark.
He was a defensive and an offensive innovator. Many of the defenses you see used today were first used by him.
He also made a physical running game another franchise signature. And few backs were as punishing as Alphonse Tuffy Lehmans. Lehmans was the second overall pick of the New York Giants in 1936, the year of the NFL's first ever college draft. Tuffy would quickly become the Giants' star workhorse, leading the league in rushing as a rookie with 830 yards. The Giants contended for the title in each of the eight seasons he played, and their success is largely attributed to his dominance as a bruising ball carrier. In 1948, New York acquired quarterback Charlie Connerly from the Washington Redskins, and he immediately emerged as the Giants' leader and field general.
Charlie Connerly is one of the strongest men of character, of strength, inner strength that any mortal I've ever known. And, you know, they talk about who would you like to have next to you in a foxhole? That's the man you want. He is just great under pressure. He was tremendous.
Connerly thrilled Giants fans with his freewheeling style of play, and he won Rookie of the Year honors in 1948. During his 13-year Giant career, Connerly played in three Pro Bowls and was the league's MVP in 1959. └1948 was also the year the Giants signed their first African-American player, defensive back Emlyn Tennell. Known as offense on defense, Tennell picked off 79 passes in his career for 1,282 yards and four touchdowns.
Emlyn Tennell was a great athlete. Em had a great awareness of what was going to happen, and he had an instinct about things. I mean, he might, all of a sudden, he'd be like a linebacker. But you think, meanwhile, his man is uncovered downfield, but it doesn't matter. He made the play at the line of scrimmage. Not many mistakes in his career, and a whole lot of great plays.
In his first 10 seasons, he never had less than six interceptions. And his 79 takeaways was a record that stood for 32 years and is still the second most in NFL history. Tennell was also spectacular on special teams, and he led the NFL in punt returns in 1951 and 1952. He amassed over 3,500 return yards and six touchdowns during his career. In 1953, Tennell actually had more interception and kick return yards, 927, than the NFL's leading rusher, Dan Towler, who ran for 894 yards. He was named to the Pro Bowl nine times, and in 1967, he became the first African-American inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. In 1950, the Giants added more power to their defense when they acquired defensive back Tom Landry and defensive end Arnie Weinmeister. Weinmeister was considered the fastest lineman in football, and he earned Pro Bowl honors in each of his four seasons with the Giants. Landry was a ball-hawking cornerback who recorded 32 interceptions in only 80 games, and he would go on to become the Giants' defensive coordinator in 1956. In 1951, New York added some flash and dash to their offense when they used their bonus pick in the draft to sign All-American halfback Kyle Rote.
Here is a Giant thrill of the year. Rote slips like quicksilver into the open. He outruns the field for 52 yards. Rote comes back on his own college gridiron. The Giants win it 24-6.
The following year, the Giants would bolster their running back position even more when they drafted USC glamour boy Frank Gifford in the 1952 NFL draft.
I loved to play. I guess I had just kind of all-around ability, whereas some people have get really fast and they can do certain things, run over people. I could do all of it fairly well.
Gifford was a multiple threat player who excelled on both offense and defense, and his all-around versatility helped the Giants return to championship glory a few years later in 1956. And in 1953, the Giants selected future Hall of Fame offensive lineman Rosie Brown in the 27th round of the NFL draft. With amazing athleticism and picture-perfect technique, Brown is perhaps the greatest sleeper pick in the NFL draft history. But after three straight seasons of missing the playoffs, the Giants faced a difficult decision. And after 23 years, head coach Steve Owen was relieved of his duties. And when assistant coach Jim Lee Howell was promoted to head coach, a new era of championship football in New York was about to begin. Stay tuned for more Giants Chronicles presented by New York Presbyterian, the early years. Welcome back to Giants Chronicles presented by New York Presbyterian Hospital, the early years. In 1954, former player and assistant coach Jim Lee Howell was asked to step in to replace the legendary Steve Owen as new head coach. Howell agreed only after securing the jobs of arguably the two greatest staff assistants in NFL history. With future Hall of Famers Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry as his offensive and defensive coordinators, Howell never had a losing season as the Giants head coach. In 1956, the Giants began playing their games in historic Yankee Stadium, and the players could not have been more pleased.
There was nothing like playing at Yankee Stadium. I mean, it was like playing in a Hall of Fame.
In their inaugural season at Yankee Stadium, New York would advance to the NFL championship game against the Chicago Bears in a sneakers game sequel.
And Triplett's blast 20 yards down to the 2-yard line. Oh, those pretty white sneakers.
We had a magical season and wound up beating the Chicago Bears for the NFL championship 47-7 in Yankee Stadium. And to win the championship in New York was something very special, too.
The 40-point drubbing gave the Giants their first championship in 18 years, and it marked the emergence of a new era of big blue defensive dominance.
In 56, I think the key to our great year was our defense. And the key to our defense is Tom Landry. And defense wins. You're not going to lose a game if the team doesn't score any points. And he developed the 4-3 defense, which still is the dominant defense in pro football today. So we had a great defense in 1956.
Landry's new defense was designed to take advantage of the instinctive skills of Giants middle linebacker Sam Huff.
When I came to New York, it was just, I was like I was born to play here. And to play there, the way we played there. I mean, all of these guys, we so blended together. We had Roosevelt Greer and Dick Moseleski, Andy Robustelli, Jim Katkavich, and Emlyn Tennell, and Jimmy Patton, and they were stars in themselves.
Today you will play pro football, riding on Sam Huff's back. We've wired him for sound with a tiny transistorized radio transmitter.
What do you do that for, 88? You do that one more time, 88, I'm going to sock you one. Now, don't do that. You run again, you'll get a broken nose. Don't do that. Hit me on the chin with your elbow.
Sam Huff, Andy Robustelli, and Dick Moseleski were the core of a new defense that would dominate the league in the late 1950s. And it was a defense that was perfectly designed to stop their arch-rival Cleveland Browns and legendary tailback Jim Brown.
In the years that we played against what I think is the greatest running back of all time, Jim Brown, it was fun just to watch Sam prepared for that week coming up against Cleveland. And Sam, as we got closer to Sunday, became even more and more intense. Of course, the media had picked up on this. It was Brown, Sam Huff, Brown, Sam Huff.
Sam was basically the quarterback of that defense, and he had the flair to understand that he was in New York, so he became an instant celebrity by attaching himself to my legs quite often.
We hit him whether he had the ball or not. And we knew that we had to stop Brown because their offense was built around him. Why shouldn't you? You know, the man averaged 5.2 yards a carry lifetime.
And in 1958, Huff and the Giants faced the ultimate challenge when they had to beat the Browns three times to make the championship game.
If we were going to be successful, we had to have the ability to stop the Cleveland Browns. They were the best team that I'd ever seen. It came out of the old All-American Conference. So I decided to develop the 4-3 defense. And it became the hallmark of defense in the 50s.
In the snowy regular season finale, it was the defense that held the Browns, setting up a dramatic game-winning field goal.
Many people were surprised that I was even in the game. In fact, the holder was the quarterback, Charlie Connerly. And he, when I got to the huddle, stuck my head in the huddle, Connerly looked at me and said, what the hell are you doing in here? Which is not exactly a way to build confidence.
Summerall kicks. It's good. The season's longest field goal. The Giants and Browns are tied for the Eastern title. There must be a playoff.
A week later, the two teams met again in Yankee Stadium, and the Giants made sure the result was the same.
We relied on our defense, and we knew we were going to shut them down. And when you shut Jim Brown down for four quarters, brother, you're doing something. Tom Landry, he set up the defense to stop the Browns, and stop them we did.
New York shut out the Cleveland Browns 10-0 to capture the Eastern Division title. The following Sunday, thousands of fans flocked to Yankee Stadium for the NFL championship game against the undefeated Baltimore Colts in a battle that would change the landscape of American sports forever. Stay tuned for more Giants Chronicles presented by New York Presbyterian, The Early Years. Welcome back to Giants Chronicles, presented by New York Presbyterian Hospital, The Early Years. On December 28, 1958, the New York Giants and Baltimore Colts would meet for the NFL championship in front of more than 65,000 fans at Yankee Stadium. A record national television audience tuned in and watched as the visitors bolted to a 14-3 halftime advantage. Baltimore threatened to put the game out of reach until the defense staged a dramatic third-quarter goal line stand. The Giants mounted a remarkable comeback, spearheaded by one of the most bizarre plays in team history.
Back King at right halfback, and flanked wide to the right goes Webster. Here's Connolly faking the King, throwing down the middle. Rhoda's in the open. He's got it, but Shakespeare's one man, Shakespeare's another. He's been chased from behind. There's a fumble on the play.
Alex Webster's quick hands and feet saved Kyle Rote and the Giants from near disaster and brought New York back into the game.
I swear there was nothing too good for Alex Webster. I would do whatever he wanted, shine his shoes there at the middle of the game, you know, whatever it was, because he really did. He saved me.
In the fourth quarter, Charlie Connerly's pass to Frank Gifford put the Giants ahead 17-14.
And the amazing Giants take the lead.
But a late rally by the Colts tied the game, setting up the first sudden-death overtime in NFL history.
And we're going to see the first application in history of the sudden-death rule. The Colts at the line of scrimmage.
And although the Giants would eventually lose,
United States begins to Amici, and the ball game is over. Alan Amici has scored the touchdown, and the Baltimore Colts are the professional football champions of the world.
The day's drama would thrust the game of football into the national spotlight.
People still remember this game because it was a crossroads game for the league, a turning point in the league history. And one of the reasons for that is the corporations, the fans, Madison Avenue, all adopted this team. And it all added to and increased the popularity of pro football, not just in New York, but nationally.
I think it was the wise and very intelligent use of television that had helped this game pick up fans around the entire country. And all of a sudden, people were watching football more than anything they watched on television. And it became a real boost. I mean, it just grew up overnight. The people who probably recognized that growth sooner than most were the people on Madison Avenue. The entire advertising world was controlled on Madison Avenue. And they were just absolutely caught up with pro football. We did advertisements for anything and everything. we were easy, if you might say. They were streetwalkers, but they It was just a magic time to be here.
Hey, Joe, are you still using that greasy kid stuff on your hair?
What else?
Vitalis. That's what else.
You ask most pro football fans who played in the championship in 1958. Baltimore, New York. Johnny Unitas. I remember him. And Charlie Connolly was a quarterback. People remember that game.
When you look back at the history of this game and the contribution that each and every one of these ball players made, it was just such a magical time. And it was a new era coming in to pro football, which made it possible for today's television and radio and everything else and bringing the fans. And now we have the number one sport in the world, pro football.
Not only did the Giants capture four NFL championships during that era, but they were also in contention in numerous other years. And most importantly, in the 1950s, they became the toast of Madison Avenue. Football players were becoming stars. They were New York Giants, which would be the entree to the explosion of the National Football League across the country. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Giants Chronicles, presented by New York Presbyterian Hospital. I'm Bob Poffel. We'll see you next week, everybody. This segment is brought to you by GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on your car insurance. Visit geico.com.